From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, Israel and Hamas are observing a three-day truce in Gaza. My colleague shares his personal experience in Israel recently.
The Philippine Department of Foreign Affairs is calling it the Triple Action Plan. DFA spokesman...
I'm sorry, apparently that was the wrong audio. HRW calls for human rights to be a focus at the Africa Summit and a project to even the playing field for Jordan's students. It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. Our next report will be from our colleague Robert Berger, who's in Jerusalem. Israel and the Palestinian militant group Hamas are observing a 72-hour ceasefire in the Gaza Strip. Since the conflict began on July 8th, nearly 1,900 Palestinians and 67 Israelis have been killed. Robert Berger reports from Jerusalem.
Israel has pulled all of its ground forces out of Gaza, signaling that the four-week offensive is winding down. The military is calling it a redeployment and says troops remain on high alert for any violations of the ceasefire by Hamas, the Islamic militant group that rules Gaza. According to the 72-hour truce brokered by Egypt, Israel and Hamas will hold indirect talks in Cairo on a formula for a long-term ceasefire. But the gaps are wide. Hamas has fired more than 3,000 rockets at Israel during the conflict, and it dug a network of tunnels that can be used by Palestinian gunmen for cross-border attacks. Israel says its air and ground assault dealt a severe blow to these capabilities, and at the talks in Cairo, it will demand the demilitarization of Gaza. Mark Regev is the spokesman for Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu.
Let everyone understand, Prime Minister Netanyahu is totally committed to create a new situation in the south where Israelis don't have to fear an incoming rocket from Hamas-controlled Gaza. And he will create that new reality.
Hamas, which is committed to armed struggle against Israel, says it will never give up its weapons. Hamas spokesman Mushir al-Masri said the war on the diplomatic front will be just as difficult as on the battlefield. Hamas's key demand is that Israel and Egypt lift a crippling 7-year blockade on Gaza. But both countries are reluctant because they fear that Gaza will be flooded with weapons. Robert Berger for VOA News, Jerusalem.
My colleague Michael Lippin is just back in Washington from a 16-day visit to Israel to be with family and friends. VOA's Steve Norman spoke with him about his experience.
I spent most of the time in Tel Aviv, but I also made a couple of day trips to Jerusalem.
And let's talk about the conflict. How did that affect your time in Tel Aviv?
Well, Tel Aviv is the financial hub of Israel. It's located on the Mediterranean coast in the center of the country, and it's about a 45-minute drive west from Jerusalem. Militants in Gaza have fired more than 3,200 rockets at Israel in the past month. Most of them are shorter-range missiles targeting southern Israel, but dozens of medium-range rockets also have reached as far as Tel Aviv and its surrounding suburbs. Now, whenever a rocket is fired from Gaza and the Israeli military determines that it's headed toward a populated area, air raid sirens are broadcast in those areas. Now, I heard sirens in Tel Aviv 7 times altogether on 7 separate days. Now, 3 of those were in the late morning, 2 of them were in the late afternoon, and 2 of them were also in the early morning. One was at 2:30 a.m., and another one at 6 a.m. last Saturday morning. Now, that's a Saturday as a rest day when many people in Israel sleep in, including me. So I woke up when I heard the siren. I quickly put on some shorts. I went into the stairwell of the apartment building that I was staying in, and then I started recording the tail end of that siren, and we can play a little clip of that for you now. Now, usually when sirens are being broadcast, you hear a couple of booms from interceptions of the rockets by Iron Dome. That's Israel's missile defense system. I did hear quite a few of those booms myself.
You know, you talked about going into the stairwell of the apartment building. What do Israelis who have been experiencing this typically do when they hear one of these sirens?
Well, authorities are constantly reminding people to go to a safe place inside a building like a stairwell or a shelter and stay away from windows or open spaces. Now, that gives you more protection in case a rocket is not intercepted and makes an impact somewhere. In most cases, though, the rockets are intercepted. But another problem is you have bits of debris falling to the ground, and those pieces also could cause injury.
VOA's Michael Lippin, who just returned to Washington from Israel. Nearly 50 African heads of state are attending a historic summit in Washington this week. Topics of discussion include how to build democracy and raise investment on the continent. Human Rights Watch is calling on U.S. President Barack Obama to also ensure that human rights concerns are a major focus of the delegates. HRW says that at least a dozen of the heads of state lead repressive governments that have imprisoned journalists, human rights defenders, and anti-corruption campaigners. Leslie Lefkow is the deputy for Africa at Human Rights Watch in Amsterdam. She spoke with VOA's Kim Lewis about human rights and investing in Africa's future.
The summit is billed at investing in Africa's future, and the main headlines are on trade, security, and development. And the concern about not including human rights more prominently is that human rights issues are closely interwoven with all of these goals. You cannot really have sustainable development and stability and security without fundamental respect for human rights, the rule of law, strong institutions, independent institutions. So the concern is that by sidelining human rights, the summit is actually ignoring one of the key criteria to reach many of the goals that it statedly wants to reach.
Also, you all have pointed out that this is an opportunity for President Obama to address the problem with the leaders right here in Washington. So how do you think he should go about doing this, and do you think he will do it?
Many, many people across the African continent, I think, were galvanized by President Obama's speech in Accra, Ghana, 5 years ago, you know, when he said that Africa needs strong institutions and not strong men. And the disappointment is that that rhetoric has not translated into sort of concrete policy changes by the U.S. government. You know, we have at least a dozen very much classical strongmen attending this summit. You have people like Angola's president, Dos Santos. You have people like Uganda's president, Museveni, you know, both of whom are well over two decades in power. And in both Angola and Uganda, you know, on either side of the continent, we've seen alarming trends of crackdowns on civil society, on the media. So this is, you know, one of the reasons why I think there's heightened concern about having this summit right now when we're seeing some really alarming human rights, negative human rights trends sweeping across the continent. And the hope is that President Obama himself and some of the events will focus on human rights a little bit more than their agenda suggests. But I think we're going to have to wait and see if that really happens in practice.
Earlier, you mentioned a couple of countries where you all found human rights violations taking place. What are some more examples of abuses that you are finding now across the continent?
I think one of the biggest worries we see when we look across the continent is this backlash, this crackdown by a number of governments on civil society, on non-governmental organizations, on human rights groups, and on independent media. So, for example, in East Africa, we see a really very clear, stark example of this trend. We see in Uganda, Ethiopia, Kenya even to some extent, South Sudan, Sudan, you see laws that are being passed or implemented that really restrict independent media from reporting on anything the governments don't want them to report on. You see laws, for example, in Ethiopia that have restrained the ability of Ethiopian human rights groups even to operate. There are really very, very few, if any, independent human rights groups who can work properly today in Ethiopia because of the legislative environment and the political environment. And this is not unique to Ethiopia. These are trends that we've seen for some years, and to some extent there's been a worsening of some of these concerns over the last few years since the popular uprisings in the Arab world, in the Middle East in 2011. We've also seen serious restrictions on public protests. riots, on peaceful demonstrations in a number of countries. So these are the kind of trends that we're really worried about, you know, that undermine the ability of citizens to call their own governments to account on a whole range of issues, from corruption to serious human rights violations to others.
Leslie Lefkow, Deputy for Africa at Human Rights Watch in Amsterdam. President Obama will be addressing African summit members today. VOAnews.com will be streaming his remarks beginning at 18:45 Universal Time. Several organizations have joined forces to improve education in Jordan for local residents and refugees. International Relief and Development is one of those trying to help. The Cultivating Inclusive and Supportive Learning Environments, or CISL, project is aimed at bringing cutting-edge techniques, including social media skills, to students. We spoke about the project with IRD's Julia Bogachoff.
This is a very dynamic educational program that USAID Jordan funded this year, 2014, the Cultivating Inclusive Supportive Learning Environments. This project is designed to ensure that all children, a local resident from Jordanian host community, and Syrian refugees are afforded an equal opportunity to a quality education and safe and supportive learning environment. And basically, the approach of this project is based on the concept that classroom teacher and the school community are sort of critical elements in achieving this educational goal. IRD focuses on several areas in this project, and three main areas are building dynamic community school partnership to support this participatory approaches to education. Another area is creating a sense of ownership and responsibility among all the stakeholders in this project within the public school system. And this public school system, of course, hosting a large number of Syrian refugees currently, refugee students. And promoting innovative and sustainable use of school space by staff, students, community, parents. So basically, IRD was selected to implement this program in partnership with Queen Rania Teaching Academy because IRD previously implemented similar project in Jordan for 5 years, funded by USAID. It was a multimillion-dollar project.
One of the programs you were working on was involving 120 students, and it was a community electronic magazine project. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, this is something that we work with to develop such projects with community parent-school coalitions in every school. So this is one of those projects that kind of come under their annual activity plans that IRD helped them to design in order to basically increase community awareness, responsibility, and advocacy for participation in education. We encourage schools to do media outreach. And e-magazine or electronic magazines is this medium where schools can actually showcase their activities, showcase their school, their achievements, their projects, special unique projects through these e-magazines. And something like that was quite a new challenge for them. And this project, CISL, helped them to learn a lot about digital media, how to use different forms of social networking, for example, blogging. Blogging was one of those techniques that not everyone was familiar with. So our trainers worked very closely with the teachers and students.
A lot of kids around the world do have access to social media, but these kids, they don't have access. So this gives them some insight that they may be able to use into their adulthood.
Yes. I mean, this is a very helpful skill, for sure. I think that the project also, not only that they don't have the skills and we're teaching them that, we also help the schools with the equipment as well. So we basically provide the tools as well as, you know, supplies and equipment for these children to do their community projects and showcase them out in the social network.
Julia Bogachoff, coordinating projects in Jordan for International Relief and Development. Two Americans who contracted the deadly Ebola disease while working in Africa seem to be improving after being treated with an experimental biotechnology drug. A company in California had seen favorable data from testing the drug on Ebola-infected monkeys, but it had not been sanctioned by U.S. health officials for use in humans. The company, however, released it for use by the two Americans after they contracted Ebola in Liberia while working there for a Christian charity. The drug was administered to Kent Brantley, a doctor, and Nancy Wrightball, a missionary, before they were flown back to the United States for treatment in an isolation tent at a hospital in Atlanta, Georgia. Officials say the health of Brantley, who arrived Saturday, appears to be improving. Wrightball returned today to the United States, and her son Jeremy says she also is showing favorable signs. Health officials say there is a very scarce number of dosages available, making it unlikely that the drug will be of immediate help in combating the current Ebola epidemic in West Africa. Taiwan is inspecting all underground gas lines for potential leaks after several underground explosions last week in the island's second-largest city killed 28 people and injured some 300 others. Prosecutors are also investigating two companies about their role in the leak of an industrial-use gas they believed caused the series of blasts. Ralph Jennings reports from Taipei.
While investigators continue to search for the exact cause of the series of explosions, authorities are taking steps to ensure that pipelines elsewhere in the country are safe. Taiwan's cabinet has ordered local governments to check the safety of underground gas pipelines by making sure the 21-year-old city and county computer records are up to date and complete. The cabinet will analyze that information and consult with 10 experts to decide what to do next. Central government official Sun Lichun explains. He says the petrochemical factories will be required to fill any gaps in the records. The central government will then have a copy of the records, he says, and then the group of experts can give advice such as what to do next and how to apply the information gathered. The city where last week's explosion occurred, industrial port Kaohsiung, has Taiwan's highest concentration of underground gas lines located near residences, about 120,000 kilometers of pipes. Another cluster of underground gas pipelines near people's homes is in a large county that includes Taiwan's main international airport. City officials in Kaohsiung say a propylene leak on Thursday evening led to the chain of explosions around midnight. The explosions blew up parts of four roads, sending cars into the air and catapulting rubble. Prosecutors in Kaohsiung have sent a team of 11 to investigate two companies suspected of piping the propylene that leaked on Thursday. It is probing LCY Chemical Corporation, which makes petrochemical products, and its gas supplier China General Terminal and Distribution Corporation. City prosecutor spokesman Huang Yanguan says the probe may lead to criminal charges. Huang says that as for whether the cause of the gas explosions is restricted to a certain company or person, the prosecutor will do a full investigation of the case and then confirm whether the cause can be blamed on a particular company or person. He adds that since the matter pertains to every aspect of evidence, the prosecutor will proceed quickly, but with no deadline. Ralph Jennings, VOA News, Taipei.
This coming Saturday, August 9th, marks the 40th anniversary of the resignation of President Richard Nixon. Mr. Nixon resigned because of his involvement in the Watergate scandal and subsequent cover-up, which began when Republican campaign operatives broke into Democratic Party headquarters in the Watergate office building in Washington in June of 1972. Watergate left a huge impact on national politics, and some of the reforms enacted in the wake of the scandal continue to reverberate today, as we hear from VOA national correspondent Jim Malone.
It was high-stakes political drama on the night of August 8, 1974, when Richard Nixon went before television cameras in the Oval Office and announced he would resign the following day.
I have never been a quitter. To leave office before my term is completed is abhorrent to every instinct in my body. But as president, I must put the interests of America first.
In an emotional speech to White House staff on the day of his resignation, Mr. Nixon touched on one of the reasons for his political downfall.
Always remember, others may hate you, but those who hate you don't win unless you hate them. And then you destroy yourself.
Shortly thereafter, the new president, Gerald Ford, sought to reassure a nation that had just witnessed the first presidential resignation in history.
My fellow Americans, Our long national nightmare is over. Our Constitution works. Our great republic is a government of laws and not of men. Here, the people rule.
Several Nixon aides went to jail for crimes and abuses of power committed during the Watergate scandal. White House tape recordings implicated Mr. Nixon in the cover-up when he ordered aides to tell the CIA to lie to the FBI in an effort to thwart the Watergate investigation. President Ford would later pardon Mr. Nixon of any criminal culpability in a move that may have cost him the 1976 presidential election, won by Democrat Jimmy Carter. The Watergate scandal remains an important turning point in U.S. political history, says American University presidential historian Alan Lichtman.
Well, Watergate remains tremendously significant. It is still, to date, the most comprehensive attempt by a president and his administration to undermine the democratic process.
The Watergate scandal unfolded over a two-year period, much of it uncovered and documented by Washington Post reporters Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein. Lichtman says the role of journalists investigating Watergate and the president's involvement in a political cover-up were crucial.
It had not been for the journalism of Woodward and Bernstein and, you know, their inside source, Nixon may well have gotten away with it. So the system worked, but it did work precariously. And, you know, the lesson is you've got to be ever vigilant.
The Watergate scandal also led to congressional reform of the campaign finance system, though some of those reforms have been undone by recent Supreme Court decisions. Watergate also ushered in a new, more divisive political era that has become even more polarized in recent years. Norman Ornstein is a political analyst at the American Enterprise Institute here in Washington.
We began to see the tensions increase, but they were nowhere near what we have now. What I see now is a level of tribalism, not simply polarization, that is something we haven't seen in the country pretty much since the period right around the Civil War.
Americans have changed their minds about one aspect of the Watergate scandal. In 1974, 59% opposed President Ford's decision to pardon Richard Nixon. But by 2002, an ABC News survey found that 59% believed that Mr. Ford had done the right thing in granting the pardon as part of an effort to reunify the country in the wake of one of the worst political scandals in its history. Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington.
The White House press secretary, who was shot and severed a devastating head wound in the 1981 assassination attempt on U.S. President Ronald Reagan, James Brady, has died at age 73. Brady's family says he suffered from a number of health problems recently. He was near President Reagan outside a Washington hotel when a gunman, John Hinckley, opened fire in an unsuccessful attempt to kill the president. Mr. Reagan was hit twice but recovered, while Brady was left paralyzed and permanently disabled. Brady went on to conduct a lifelong campaign for tighter U.S. gun controls. A U.S. law requiring background checks on gun buyers bears his name, and the Brady Campaign to Prevent Gun Violence is named after him. His name also appears on a plaque just outside the White House press briefing room, where Monday the current White House press secretary, Josh Earnest, spoke about James Brady.
I was aware that Mr. Brady was in failing health in recent days, and I was saddened when I first learned of that. He is somebody who I think really revolutionized this job. And even after he was wounded in that attack on the president, was somebody who showed his patriotism and commitment to the country by being very outspoken on an issue that was important to him and that he felt very strongly about. So he leaves the kind of legacy that I think that certainly this press secretary and all future press secretaries will aspire to live up to.
White House Press Secretary Josh Earnest. James Brady began his career in public service as a staff member in the office of Illinois Senator Everett Dirksen in the 1960s. He also served as press secretary to then-presidential candidate John Connally in 1979. After Connally dropped out of the race, Brady eventually became director of public affairs. Thank you for joining us today. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington.